Hello everyone, my name is Elijah David, minister of 12th Hour Apostolic Sabbatarian Congregation. Now I'm at the 12th Hour and the Elder in Texas. Today is September the 24th is the 26th day of Tishri, 2028. We will start our first service on this Sabbath day with a song, and then we'll go into our regular service. We're going to do this here at the 11th hour by the V.T. Holler, and I crossed the line through the word 11, number 11, and I put 12 there. But actually, V.T. Holler is talking about the 11th hour, judging beginning at the house of Yahweh, with the Willis W. Johnson in 1970. That's when the 11th hour began, the literal 11th hour, and closed out in 2003 with Willis Johnson at the helm. So, Richard Hollis, before he died in 1955, he wrote this fact about 1954, and it didn't get published in the Rod, but it got published in the track. And there's a lot of inspiration that we need to pick up on, because the judgment of the dead closed out with information from this tract of V.T. Holler, and the judgment really began. This is how we connect it on. For our prayer thought, let's read from answer book number 4 by V.T. Holler. We're on page 38. It says, the last paragraph, page 37. The name of the was "What About Peter and the Cheese?" Okay, question number 95, and answer book number 4. It says, please explain Matthew 16:15-19. Why did Yahshua give the cheese to Peter? Why not to another or to all? Answer. Peter was the only one who gave the right answer. And I might say I gave a straight and right answer to the question, "But whom say ye that I am?" Therefore, to Peter and to none other, Yahshua said, "I will give unto thee the keys of the kingdom of heaven," having first assured him that flesh and blood hath not revealed it unto him, but his Father which is in heaven. And Yahweh makes man to understand something which is beyond finite knowledge. The Bible terms the act inspiration. Okay. Hence, Yahshua pronounced Peter inspired for this inspiration, and Yahshua testimony. Therefore, were the keys to the central theme of the man's salvation. Knowledge of the Son of Yahweh, this is the truth, the gospel that had to be proclaimed. It should read that this is the present truth that had to be proclaimed. Now leave that word gospel out, because the truth of the kingdom is not the gospel. The word inspiration is not the gospel. That had to be proclaimed. It was the present truth, an inspired message direct from the Yahweh. just possessed of a revelation by which every man was to be judged, either for salvation or for the condemnation. Peter and his associates became responsible either for the unlocking or for the locking up salvation unto every living soul under the heavens. Consequently, when Yahshua gave the keys unto Peter, he gave him the gospel, the understanding and preaching of the plan of salvation of the everlasting covenant of Yahshua, the new and living way, Hebrews 10, 19 and 20. That's what the gospel was that he gave to Peter and everybody that had present truth since then, and a divine commission to preach it. And so long as Peter and his co-workers were true to this charge, just so long did they possess the keys to lock or to unlock the men, unlock unto men the kingdom of the Yahweh, and to have sanction in heaven wherever they bound or loosed on earth, accordingly with the inspiration and progressive revelation, present truth, go with the keys. In other words, in present truth goes with the keys. Obviously, therefore, a message from the heaven proclaimed by the Yahweh's chosen servant is all powerful, and by it man's eternal destiny is decided. Plainly then, the keys are not the church herself, but are in the message which she proclaimed. So no man or set of men has power to loose or bind with the heaven's apparent approval, save at the instance of a message thus saved directly from heaven for them to bear for the time then present. Different periods in the history of the church have each been marked by the development of some special truth adapted to the necessities of the Yahweh's people at that time. Comment by the great Sister White, the Great Controversy, page 609. It has been so from the time immemorial. For the Noah also had the keys and was thus able for the loosing or binding both in heaven and on the earth. The fact that even the gates of hell could not prevail against the ark bears witness unto this fact. And the Yahweh promised unto Abraham, I will bless him that blesses thee, and curse him that curses thee, and in thee shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Genesis 12:3. Shows that he too had the keys of heaven. Also, in the providentially controlled hand of the Moses, the keys swung open the gates of the kingdom for the freedom and salvation of the righteous, and closed them in the doom upon the wicked. Thus Moses said, hereby you shall know that the Yahshua has sent me to all these works, for I have not done them of my own mind. If these men die the common good of all men, or if they be visited after the visitation of all men, then the Yahshua has not sent me. But if the Yahshua makes a new thing, or the Yahweh, the Father, makes a new thing, let's do that again, I said. If these men die the common death of all things, or if they be visited after the visitation of all men, then the Yahweh, the Father, hath not sent me. And actually, when they say Lord here, they're talking about Yahshua, so let's stay with that. Then the Yahshua hath not sent me. But if the Yahshua make a new thing, and the earth open her mouth and swallow them up with all the that pertain unto them, and they go down quick into the pit, then you shall understand that these men have provoked the Yahshua and the Father Yahweh, and it came to pass, as he had made an end of speaking all these words, that the ground cave ascended that was under them, and the earth opened her mouth and swallowed them up, and their houses, and all the men that appertain unto Korah, and all their goods, number 16, 28 to 32. Though assuming that Moses Yahweh committed the key unto the kingdom for the Hebrew host, and withdrew them in the Yahshua's day, when the Jews rejected him, then he transferred the keys to the founders of the apostolic church of the apostles, of the 12 apostles, and Peter being the one that was specifically granted the keys. But notwithstanding the example of the past, the adherence of the apostles eventually also repeated the mistakes of the Moses followers. Yet throughout the Dark Ages, and especially during the Reformation period, Yahweh continued for the entrusting to entrust the messengers after, or to entrust the message after, let's do that again. And especially during the Reformation period, Yahweh continued to entrust messenger after messenger and movement after movement with the divine legacy. But again, and again, down to the Reformation, unto the call of William Miller, and the Reformation began with Martin Luther in 1500 A.D. That was called out of the Catholic Church. For each successive group repeated the folly of becoming satisfied with the static message, until finally when all the Protestant churches of the Miller's day rejected the message for that time, they too unwittingly refused to be any longer the custodians of the sacred keys. Thus Miller and his associates possessed them until the time of the Yahweh's next message, the judgment of the dead, 1844, committed unto Ellen G. White, when the sacred keys passed from the Millerite movement, that's Revelation 3:7, unto the Seventh-day Adventist denomination, and that's Revelation 3:6 to 12, But if it now rejects Yahweh's pleading for the anointing of his eyes with the eyesight which he is offering unto it, it also will let the seed slip from its grasp and pass into the hand of those who are to proclaim the additional message. And that additional message is the judgment of the living. It's the message of the loud cry. That has to be the third angel, has to be joined with the fourth and fifth angel, Revelation 7 and 18, and have the Pentecostal power to swell it into a loud cry to go around the world. See early writings 279. And tragedy of the tragedy, this very thing, the later sins are in this blindness, thereby repeating the history of Yahweh's people through the ages, under whom should my tithe go? That's my next subtitle. That's the next question number 96 on the answer book number 4. I asked to read the author. Let's go ahead and read that. It says, while still holding the membership in the Seventh-day Adventist denomination, should one pay tithe unto the Davidian Seventh-day Adventist? Answer. One can best answer this question by asking himself the following question. Do I believe that the Shepherd God contains a message of the hour? As a sealing message of the 144,000. Have I received any spiritual help from it? Has it caused me to repent of the formerly indulged sin? Am I now a better Seventh-day Adventist than I was before I accepted it? Has it made me love the Bible, the spirit of the prophecy, and the brethren more than ever before? If one's answer unto each of these questions is no, then he should pay his tithe to the Seventh-day Adventist Church, of which he is still a member. If his answer to them is yes, and if he is still in the doubt as to where he should pay his tithe, then he should further question himself. Had I continued in the lead of sin, the course in which the rod found me, could I be saved and ready to meet the Yahshua this coming? Can my Seventh-day Adventist brethren be saved by remaining in their present condition? If to these questions one's answer is no, then his answer to the following question will instruct him where to pay his tithe. Since I am responsible for the light which is now shining upon my pathway, and since I must have given it unto my brethren, should I pay my tithe to the Seventh-day Adventist denomination so that the ministry may have more money with which to fight both the message and my present endeavors for the reaching of the people with the present truth message of the rod, and thereby working at the cross purposes, only help to keep them in the darkness? Or should I pay it unto the division, the storehouse of the present truth, where it naturally should go, for the promoting of the advancement of a heart-searching reformation, and for the rescue of my Seventh-day Adventist brethren unto eternal ruin. And as they themselves are not prepared for the meeting of Yahshua, Testimony of Ryan 6, page 371, then how can they adequately prepare the heathen in the view of all these facts? Shall my child go to the Seventh-day Adventist denomination in behalf of the heathen, or unto the sealing message in behalf of the brethren? If I dare not place my tithe to the support of what I believe to be the present truth, then how will it be supported? And where else can I conscientiously place my tithe? Furthermore, I place it in the denomination to be used largely for the evangelizing of the worldling, rather than in the storehouse of the present truth to be used for the benefit of my brethren, then am I not doing so to the neglect of my own brethren, and thus denying that I am my brother's keeper? And all I am moreover to obey the minister's order to go in search of sheep in the house of Baal, instead of heeding the Yahshua's express command to take the heaven-sent remedy to the sin-sick sheep in the house of Israel, as the 10 says, which of these two endeavors should be the more sure to gain for me the commendation? Well done, thou great and faithful servant. Thou hast been faithful over a few things. I will make thee ruler over many things. Enter thou into the joy of thy Yeshua. Matthew 25:21. Who then is a faithful and wise servant, whom his master has made ruler over his household, to give them meat in due season? Blessed is that servant whom his master, when he cometh, shall find so doing. Matthew 24:45-46. Now, if after having answered these questions to your satisfaction, you are still undecided as to what you should do with your tithe, then read tract number 4, The Latest News for Mother, 1943 edition, page 63-70. Then remember Lot's wife, and do as Yahshua bids you. Okay. It says, that's the end of that. Cannot my home be at his storehouse? Is it scripture? This is question 97. For one to retain and personally use his tithe and offerings in order to carry on the gospel work in his own community according unto his own plan? Answer. Nowhere in the scriptures do we find permission to use the Yahshua's money at our own discretion. Well, the only justification for the so doing would be sheer inability for some reason to send it to the Yahshua storehouse. Should one voluntarily, though, engage in such a practice, then he would set the wrong example before others, and if following in his lead, others assume the same right, their course must inevitably result in the seriously handicapping Yahshua's work, leading and subverting his treasure, and thus disorganizing his work and reducing the church into a mere shell, while her members are hiring themselves as laborers in the Yahshua's vineyard, helping themselves to Yahshua's name and running without having been sent, what a Babylon that would be. Though the Yahshua's comments bring you all the tithes into the storehouse, Matthew, Malachi 3:10, he does not say to bring all the offerings, thus he shows that if we would engage in some personal charity or missionary activity, we should sustain it from the offerings and not from the tithes. Angels keep a faithful record of every man's work, and as the judgment passes upon the house of Yahweh, the sentence of each is recorded by his name, and the angel is commissioned to spare not the unfaithful servant, but to cut them down at the time of the slaughter, and the crowns they might have worn had they been faithful are put upon the heads of those saved by the faithful servant. Testimonies, Volume 1, page 198, by Ellen G. White. Question number 98. Is it not my duty to sit right to Yahshua's treasury? Should we pay our tithe to the storehouse if we know that it is not used rightly? Knowing that our tithe belongs unto Yahweh's storehouse, our greatest burden should be to see that it is safely paid there. Nowhere in the Bible do we find that Yahshua has laid upon any tithe payer the policy of the channels through which these funds pass. Yahshua's treasury is under his control, and if he himself should not see fit to correct an abuse in the handling of his money, certainly we could not correct it, however hard we might try. If we guard carefully that part of his work which he entrusts unto us, our only concern will be to find out where his storehouse is, and then faithfully to deposit his money there. He has not made us responsible for its use, that he will personally take over, even as he is now taking the reins in his own hands. Well, that's what happened out in Kermit. Willis Johnson received tithes for 33 and a half years from people, members of his church, including myself. I paid him tithes all that time. My wife paid him tithes all that time. And when Yahshua came at the Passover 2002, he took the reins in his own hands and he passed the reins on to me to take charge of the on-moving church of the Gilead Center, Kermit, Texas. Transferred it from Royal Johnson to Denton Brunken. And that includes, I inherited all the keys to his property, the business, the church, the administration building. And he refused to give me the keys, and he lost it all to the city. The city took over and ended up with all of it. And he never ended up, not even with his own car that he was driving. He had to be hauled out of there by somebody else's car. He lost all of his vehicles and everything. Alright. When the promised land was divided among the 12 tribes of the Israel, the tribe of the Levi received no land for an inheritance, as did the 11 tribes. Instead, Yahshua decreed that the tithes of the other tribes were to go to the Levites. This was their inheritance. It was actually their own. And just as they, as the tithe receivers, had no right to dictate to the others, the tithe payers, what to do with their own increase after it had been tithed, so the tithe payers had no right to dictate unto the tithe receivers what to do with the tithe. Each tribe was itself to be accountable to the Yahshua for that which he had entrusted unto it. Thus it must be today. What is subject to tithing? Deuteronomy 14:22 says, "Thou shalt truly tithe all the increase of thy seed, that the field bringeth forth year by year, now shall I tithe my crop." No facilitate answering this question. Let us consider, for example, the case of a potato grower. Say that he is without expense for the hard labor, irrigation, rent, etc. If free from such overhead, and if his gross return of $50 an acre, then the whole amount would be subject to the tithe, which would be $5 an acre. If, however, he must operate with an overhead expense to produce his crop, then obviously even such expense should be deducted from the gross value of the produce and only the remainder tithe. For instance, if the gross value of the crop be $50 an acre and the overhead expense is $10 an acre, then the net increase, the amount subject to the tithe, would be $40 an acre, and the tithe only $4 instead of $5 an acre. If, on the other hand, one is a wage earner, sustaining the expense of the Social Security, transportation to and from work, etc., then he deducts the amount of such expenses from his wages before tithing them. For example, if he receives $100 a month wages, and if he must spend 10 cents a day, or about $2.60 a month for transportation, he then deducts $2.60 from $100, which leaves the $97.40 to tithe. If one income is from rentals, then he deducts the amount spent on upkeep of the property from his untithed gross income. Thus, figuring one's income, one tithes all his increase. What about tithing gifts? Since the Bible teaches that one should tithe all his increase, should not one therefore pay tithe on all gifts? Answer. This is question number 100. Used as a noun, the word increase means that which is added unto the original stock profit, the return from one's labor or inheritance, as we do not know whether it can therefore be scripturally construed to enjoin paying tithe on the small love gifts. The decision must rest entirely with the individual. Okay. What insurance should the Christians carry? That's question 101. Okay, that's pretty American foods are Curacao on the Feast of the Kingdom that was originally given to Peter in the New Testament and passed on to his successors. William Miller had them in 1833. He had the Feast of the Kingdom laid on him. That's in Revelation 3:7. And likewise, those truths are passed on to his successors that have inspiration of present truth in the kingdom. And that would be Ellen G. White, succeeded William Miller, B.T. Hollis succeeded Ellen G. White, Ben Rhodes succeeded B.T. Hollis, then Roland Shantz succeeded Ben Rhodes, and Elijah Davis succeeded Roland Shantz. 2003. Okay. Let us go now into our regular studies. Okay. At the 11th hour, Judgment of the Living, that's the title of our sermon. Judgment of the Living at the 11th Hour is our official title, written by the Vichy Hala somewhere back in 53-54, his last tract that didn't get published in the Rock. It says, page part one, for the Judgment of the Living at the 11th Hour, and the 11th Hour struck in 1970, with the brother Stephen Johnson at the helm. And he started off calling his movement, the Isaac Ranch, the Gilead Center, he's calling it the Judgment of the Living. And he was using this here title for B.T. Hollis. Okay, at the 11th hour. He called his at the Judgment of the Living at the 11th hour. So, I identified the Judgment of the Living at the 11th hour because that's 2 hours before sundown. The beginning of the 11th hour is exactly 2 hours before sundown at the end of the 12th hour. So, the 11th hour was next to the last hour. Now, Yahshua said in John 11:9, are there not 12 hours in a day, work while you have the light. In our tract number 15, unto the seven churches, inspiration opens unto the view of momentous truth in the book of the Revelation. Now in these pages it brings them into the fuller, clearer perspective. Thus, in this companion sit track, number 15 and 16, the student of the revealed truth may find a connecting link in the great chain of the events. Track number 15 closely demonstrates that in the epitome, the revelation presents only or exactly what the angel declared in the following verses. Could the Yahweh and give glory unto him, for the hour of his judgment is come. Revelation 14:7. And 1 hour is thy Babylon, Babylon's judgment, come. Revelation 18:10. I saw thrones, and they sat upon them, and judgment was given unto them. Revelation 20, verse 4. For the dead were judged out of those things which were written in the books. Verse 12. They were judged every man according unto their works. Verse 13. And whosoever was not found written in the book of life was cast into the lake of fire. verse 15. The judgment and the two sessions. That's tract number 15. Further reveals chapter 4 and 5 of the Revelation. Present a pictorial representation of the human race at the bar of judgment. When the cases of all, small, and great are laid bare through the all-searching gaze of a tribunal to determine also who have not the wedding garment on. Those who have stayed for the marriage supper, those who have not are bound hand and foot and cast into outer darkness. There to wail and to gnash their teeth, Matthew 22:13. For their failure to respond to divine love, then and there their fate, their eternal destiny, is forever settled. This is exactly what will be seen on the first section and session of the judgment since 1844, before the day is ended, and the time is come that judgment must begin at the house of Yahweh. 1 Peter 4:17. And for the living, which is the second session and session of the judgment of all whose names have by profession been entered in the Lamb's Book of Life, it will cleanse the sanctuary church from sin and sinners. No longer will the tares be left among the wheat, Matthew 13:30, the bad fish among the good, Matthew 13:47-48, the ghosts among the sheep, Matthew 25:32-33. The Yahweh, whose sand is in his hand, will thoroughly purge his floor and gather his wheat into the garner, that he will burn up the shaft with the unquenchable fire. Matthew 3:12. Judah, the keeper of solemn feast. For this judicial work of the cleansing of the house of the Yahweh, the initial work of the judgment of the living, is now mercifully awaiting in this fast-fleeting pre-11th hour of the grace of the self-judging, 1 Corinthians 11:31, 1 Timothy 5:24. Our response to the voice of the message, crying, awake, awake, put on thy strength, O Zion, put on thy beautiful garment, O Jerusalem, the holy city, for henceforth there shall no more come unto thee the uncircumcised and the unclean. Isaiah 52:1. I beheld upon the mountain the feet of him that bringeth good tidings. This gospel of the kingdom, Matthew 24:14, our purified house of the Yahweh, that publishes peace, O Judah, keep thy solemn feast, perform thy vows, for the wicked shall no more pass through thee in the kingdom. He is utterly cut off. Nahum 1:15. So then, because thou art lukewarm and neither cold nor hot, I will spew thee out of my mouth, because thou sayest, I am rich and increasing good, and have need of nothing. Knowest not that thou art wretched and miserable and poor and blind and naked. I counsel thee to buy of me gold tried in the fire, that thou mayest be rich, and white raiment, that thou mayest be clothed, and that the shame of thy nakedness do not appear, and anoint thine eyes with the eyesight, that thou mayest see. As many as I love, I rebuke and chasten. Be zealous, therefore, and repent. Revelation 3:16-19. And it shall come to pass at that time that I will search Jerusalem with the candles, and punish the men that are still on their lead, that say in their heart, the Yahweh will not do good, neither will he do evil. Therefore their goods shall become a booty, and their houses a desolation. They shall also build houses, but not inhabit them. And they shall plant vineyards, but not drink the wine thereof. For the great day of the Yahweh is near, it is near and hasten greatly, even the voice of the day of Yahweh, for the mighty man shall cry to the bitter. Zephaniah 1:12-14. This Isaiah, Nahum, and Zephaniah, along with the others of the prophets, prophesied of the judgment which John saw was to be hereafter. Revelation 4:1. From his time, now we come to the time of that solemn event, the judgment, as the central message of the book of the Revelation, in which, remember, all the books of the Bible meet and end. Acts of the Apostles, page 585. For the fifth chapter of Revelation needs to be closely studied. That's the judgment of the living. The fifth chapter of Revelation has its beginning prophecy unfolding with Elijah David 2002. It's from the text, the changing of the guard from Rhoda Johnson to Elijah David. It is of the great importance to those who shall actually part in the work of the Yahweh for his last day. There are some who are deceived. They do not realize what is coming on earth. Unless they make a decided change, they will be found wanting when the Yahweh pronounces judgment upon the children of men. Testimony 9:267. For the Yahweh will bless all who will seek only and make it to understand that which is revealed in the Revelation. This book contains so much that is large and more intelligible and full of the glory that all who read and search it earnestly receive the blessing. To those that hear the words of this prophecy and seek those things which are written therein. Testimony 9:14. Page 9 is a chart of the investigative judgment, the seven seals. Page 9, a wonderful revelation. With this simple focus of the concern being the judgment, the revelation necessarily speaks to the seven centuries before the annual event. The convening of the judgment, which John was triggered to see panoramically as a judgment book containing the record of all time, works of all nations and people, and seal with the seven seals, is opened by the Lion of the tribe of Judah, Revelation 5:9-11. As life consecutively broke the seal, he thus progressively opened the book. When fully opened, the seven seal section of the Revelation revealed that which was to take place at the time that the nations and people were to pass in review before the judicial throne, as this depicted in the chapters 4 and 5, and as clearly unveiled in our companion chapter number 15. Indeed, in the Revelation, all the books of the Bible meet and end, Acts of the Apostles, 585. And all the nations and prophets and the people too. Through the Revelation, therefore, we who live during the judgment hour can see the past, the present, and the future. We behold prophecies fulfilled, being fulfilled, and yet to be fulfilled as the judgment progresses. We have the extra all measure, clearly as the judgment of the living is the most important work immediately in the connection with the present truth of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, that leaves the light on it now more than on any other concern. Only this meet in the due season, Matthew 24:45-46, and impart unto her this spiritual vision and strength to keep pace with the fast fulfilling sign of the time, with the Yahshua's work in the heaven and on the earth, and with her call and her duty. Consequently, this is the nomination, said the evidence, then it's the nomination, now fails to avail herself of this extra oil, and in Matthew 25 and on, for her lamp, of the presenter, and just as soon as the judgment of the dead gives way to the judgment of the living, that took place starting at the Passover 2002 at Gilead Center in Congregation with Brother Johnson. As the ancient man before the house, Ezekiel 9:6, that was judged and visited first to start the judgment of the living, and the beginning of the 12th hour, and close out the judgment of the dead. She will find herself with her lamp gone out, leaving her in the dense darkness without any rest. Meet in the due season, and thus without light for herself and for the world, and hence without hope. Seals and trumpets is our next subtitle. By the means of the symbol, the seals disclose progressive truth, and they open the deeds of the nations and peoples collectively for the one truth following another period by period, the seven periods in all. Then an eighth one is the column for a detailed study of the seven seals. See our companion track number 15 to the seven churches. Having unfolded in the seven seals one page of the truth that concerning the sealing, period's inspiration follows with the seven trumpets containing the complementary page of the truth. That of the destruction which results from the rejection of the sealing truth. Thus, the trumpets envision the work of the faithful and the destruction of the unfaithful. Revelation chapter 8, verse 11. For a verse by verse study of the seven trumpets, request our chart number 5, the final warning. Page 11. The living prophet in the church is our next subtitle. After concluding the events of the trumpet, the revelation, bears record, chapter 12, of the ever-living church and her enemy, the dragon. There we are told that the earth helps her by the opening of its mouth and swallowing up the dragon's blood, Revelation 12:16. For the hypocrites in the church, this further illustration of the cleansing work in the house of the Yahweh discloses when it is at the remnant to escape the vision of the 144,000 first fruits harvest of the Seventh Day Adventist Church, at the closing of the judgment of the dead and opening up the judgment of the living, and the 12th parabolic hour, Isaiah 4:2, those who are now swallowed up by the earth find themselves in a conflict with the dragon. Then it is that as a group they keep the commandments of Yahweh and still have the testimony of Yahshua, Revelation 12:17. The ever-living spirit of the prophecy, Revelation 19:10, manifested through a living prophet in the church, history of the mankind. Obvious it is that in the day of the judgment, each seal and each trumpet, first one and then the other in the sevenfold succession, discloses the events and the respective categories. With the seals embracing the total sealing phase of the whole history of the mankind and the trumpet's embracing, the complementary phase of the consequent destruction upon the rejections of the present truth and their time. Coming now to chapter 13 and 17, we view a threefold symbolization with a special representation of the world yesterday, today, and tomorrow as it stands before the judgment throne of the Yahweh. First we behold the leopard-like beast, followed by the two-horned beast, then the scarlet-colored beast. Okay, page 13 is the chart of the world's history and the prophetic symbols. We just closed out 12. Having seven heads and 10 horns, the body of a leopard, the feet of a bear, and the mouth of a lion, the leopard-like beast is manifested. A composite symbol made up of the components of the four beasts of Daniel, the head of the lion, Babylon, the feet of the bear, Medo-Persia, the body of the leopard, Grecia, and the 10 horns of the nondescript beast, Rome. Thus, this composite symbolization obviously reveals that the leopard-like beast is a descendant of the Daniel's four beasts, and is therefore a melting pot, as is said of the ancient nations in general, and he speaks the world of today, and the particularly necessary so too, because all nations of the past as well as of the present, both dead and living, must come before the throne of the judgment, hence their being embodied in the composite beast symbolization. Symbolism. Moreover, the 10 crownless horns of the Daniel's fourth or non-descript beast, being symbolical of the king that were to arise from the disintegration of the Roman Empire, Revelation 17, 12, and the contrast to the 10 crown horns of the John's leopard like beast, Revelation 13, 1-2, prove that the latter beast is in the particular the symbol of the world after the fall of the pagan Rome. Now this is still more vividly seen when we bring into sharp focus the fact that the crownless horns kings of the Daniel 4 beast show that they had not yet possessed their kingdom, whereas later on the John's first beast they are crowned, showing that they had finally taken their kingdom. For the John's second, our scarlet colored beast, ridden, driven by a woman, a religious system, with his crownless horn, Revelation 17, 12, is seen to represent a period of the crownless king, again symbolizing a governmental entity. And the principle and nature cast in the mold of that during the supremacy of the ecclesiastical Roman Church, state rule, unmistakably, this third beast is a symbol of the oncoming church, state world of the dawning tomorrow, with its crownless horns then. Plainly reveal that the leopard-like beast, crowned king, which arose from the ruins of the Roman Empire, and which have descended down unto our day, are to be dethroned and superseded by the crownless king, by the dictators of the lesser lights, Okay. Yes, sir. This brings in rest that this is our contact list at the Living Protocol. And that's another living tip on our audio archive. We're going to close now with a sound.